I could have your attention. Hello, my name is Lisa Falsco. I'm CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council. And our speaker's not quite here yet, but we're going to go ahead and get started. I know we have a lot of students who have some buses, so we'll just go ahead and start with the program. It is so great to see everyone here today. This is the first program of our season, and we are thrilled. We are so excited. We have been working very hard this summer, and our board members, we have a brand new board for the year 2013-2014. I saw some faces in the crowd. I don't know if I saw Commissioner Sullivan, who just came back from Afghanistan last night, but if you are an Alaska World Affairs Council board member, would you mind standing up and being recognized? Do we have some other? I saw Chuck Becker here. Thank you so much. These folks have been working hard and putting together a lot of exciting ideas. Some things we're going to be doing this year, in addition to our regular Friday lunch programs, we're going to have some movies at both the Bear's Tooth and Alaska Public Media, followed by panel discussions. We're going to have some evening programs in partnership with the Alaska Dispatch, where we will feature Alaskans on topics that are important here in Alaska. We're going to start the first ever Alaska World Music Festival in partnership with Alaska Public Media, the Concert Association, Bridge Builders, the Native Heritage Center, and we're also going to start a WorldWiz Pub Trivia Night. So, pick up a brochure, a flyer on what we're doing, and check out our website and let us know what you think. Today we have a bread basket donated by Great Harvest Bread Company. I didn't see too many raffle tickets in there, so if you want to rush to the front and get a raffle ticket, you have about 2 minutes, and we'll pick the lucky winner to see who wins the basket today. If you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. Today's program is being recorded for the radio. Thank you so much for Will Toyer over here in the corner who is recording. This program will be available on both Alaska Public Media's website, alaskapublic.org, and the Alaska World Affairs Council website. So please go to their website to see this program as well as some of our past programs, or I should say listen to the program. We are a membership organization, and like I said, our season is just beginning today, so if you have not renewed your membership, or if you're currently not a member, please consider joining and support these great programs and opportunities for the community and our students. Speaking of students, do we have any students here in the audience? Would you mind standing up and being recognized? We are so thrilled to see some students today. Ah, fantastic. Thank you so much for coming. And we'd like to thank BP for sponsoring our student programs. They are sponsoring this program as well as our entire season. So thank you very much to BP for doing that. And speaking of students, our speaker, I don't know if you know, but we always invite our speaker to visit a local high school while they're here. And 9 times out of 10, they say, yes, we'd be happy to go to a local high school and share with your youth. Well, our speaker today went to 3 places. He went to Bartlett High School yesterday, UAA yesterday, West High School this morning, and then he's here for us today. So we really appreciate all that he's given to our community. If this is your first Alaska World Affairs Council program, would you mind raising your hand? Do we have any brand new people who have never been to a World Affairs Council program? Ah, fabulous, fabulous. Well, if you like this program, please come again. We are going to have a program this coming Tuesday. It's not a normal day. We don't normally have programs, but when opportunities like this come about, we do it when we can. And this Tuesday is going to be a program with Ambassador David Balton and Fran Ulmer, who will talk about U.S. leadership in an emerging Arctic. So please consider coming back on Tuesday for that. And I'd also like to recognize 2 folks who were very instrumental in getting the word out to our fabulous military personnel, who I see so many of. Randy Banez, if you could please raise your hand. And Lieutenant Colonel Orm, thank you so much for helping us get the word out and letting folks know about this opportunity. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce our head table. To my far left, we have Chuck Colson, our incoming chairman of the board. Garrett Wong's term has expired, and he has some big shoes to fill, but Mr. Colson has a lot of energy to fill those shoes, and is hitting it running, and we are so excited by all that he is doing. So, Mr. Chuck Colson. And to his right, I'd like to bring up to the podium Chancellor Case. You may know him from a previous life as a 3-star lieutenant general, also maybe as Alaska World Affairs Council board member. And now he is our beloved Chancellor of UAA, Chancellor Case.
Well, thank you, Elise. We're in for a real treat today. Our speaker, Bart O'Neill, has a tremendous resume, and I'd like to go over some of the formal parts of that to begin with. Now with the National War College Foundation and a speaker around the country, he spent a number of years as a professor of international affairs and director of studies of internal warfare and terrorism at the National War College. If you Google Bart O'Neill, you will find more books than you can count that he has authored. He is a true expert in this area. Some of his books, Insurgency and Terrorism, The Deadly Embrace, The Impact of Israeli and Palestinian Rejectionism and the Peace Process, and the list goes on and on. He has lectured extensively in the United States and overseas on insurgency and terrorism. He's been a consultant to the U.S. government, a number of agencies, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, CIA, NSA, and he's appeared as a guest analyst on CBS, CNN, C-SPAN, and the Asian News Network and NPR. Bart O'Neill really knows what he's talking about. And I can tell you that from firsthand experience because I was indeed very fortunate to be with Bart for 2 years back in the 80s at the National War College. And he has had an unbelievable influence on generations of military officers and agency students who came through the National War College by his deep understanding of terrorism and this whole array. But beyond that, a framework for how to think about those things. Tremendously influential. We're really sorry he couldn't be here at the table, but I am told that before Dr. O'Neill speaks, we have the rare opportunity to hear from a senior Al-Qaeda strategist. Is security in the room? Do we have security?
In the name of Allah, the merciful and the compassionate, maker of the heavens and the earth, the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, our brave holy warriors, the Mujahideen, and the Islamic community, the Ummah. If you are interested in strategy, you would know, as we know, all of the great books. You would have read Clausewitz on war, and you would know he has said, if you are going to enter into a war, you had better understand the nature of that war. The wisdom from the Orient in Sun Tzu, The Art of War, know yourself, know your enemy, fight 1,000 battles, win 1,000 battles. I submit to you that you do not know your enemy, and worse than that, you do not know yourselves. We declared war on you in the late 1990s, and we were fully prepared for that war, having fought the Russians in Afghanistan. We had been studying all the texts and the writings and the theories of insurgencies, internal wars, from Mao, the Cuban experience with Che Guevara and Fidel Castro, the Algerian experience. The list was long. And what were you doing? What was your military doing They were preparing for major land-air battles. Like good generals and admirals, they were preparing for the last war that they fought. We were preparing for the future war. And so you were surprised on 9/11. You shouldn't have been. You should have known about us. And I ask you, what do you really know about Al-Qaeda? What did you know? What did you know about our assumptions regarding the world, the things that underpin our strategy? What did you know about our thinking with respect to forms of violence? What did you know about our strategy? What did you know about our organization? What do you know today about these things? If you're in a war, know your enemy. If you're going to engage in a war, understand the nature of that war. There are no excuses. We know from your post-mortem analyses that you have acknowledged you were unprepared while we were prepared. So let me share with you Al-Qaeda's thinking. Why did we declare war on you? We declared war on you because, in essence, you have been at war with Islam for centuries. And in more recent times, the United States, as the most important power in the international system, has led this onslaught on the part of the West to destroy Islam. Sayyid al-Qutb, our contemporary intellectual godfather, has written in his magisterial work, In the Shadow of the Quran, about these things. Sayyid al-Qutb went to school in northern Colorado. So you see, he walked among you, and he observed the debauchery that marks your society. But more important than anything else, he came to understand that it is your mission to destroy Islam. And you sit there today with puzzled looks. What does he mean? So let me share with you how we see this world. What is in our mind that you call a terrorist mind, which, by the way, we're comfortable with. I will ask you a question here. What are you about when you come into places like the Middle East or South Asia? You have tried to separate mosque from state. You have brought the gospel of secularization. You have brought that because you want to westernize and destroy our culture. You are comfortable with separation of church and state, synagogue and state, mosque and state, and we are not. This betrays you. It demonstrates you have no understanding of the philosophical and legal bases of Islam. In Islam, all spheres of human endeavor, politics, art, literature, music, name the sphere, are unified. There is no separation of mosque and state. And the reason for this is we have Islamic law, the Sharia. The Sharia, in turn, is derived from the Quran, from the sayings of the Prophet, the Hadith, and the Sunnah, the traditions of early Islam. So we have God's laws. We know what is acceptable, and we know what is haram, prohibited. It is given by God. It is our duty to live in accordance with this. How dare you intrude and try to separate mosque and state? Let us be candid here. When is the last time Islamic tanks, ships, and airplanes were on your soil, off your coast, or in your airspace, threatening you? And by the looks on your face, the answer is, we can't recall any of that. But your tanks, ships, and planes, Western powers, have been on our lands and off our coasts and in our airspace for as long as we can remember. The underlying purpose being to destroy Islam. And so Sayyid al-Qutb then continued with his writings. And he wrote a book called Signpost, Guidelines. And he essentially said, because of this purpose that you have, there will be an inevitable confrontation. There are only two parties in this world. There is the party of Allah, and there is the party of Satan and rebellion, which you represent. And there can be no compromise between these two. So this will be a confrontation, and this confrontation will be one of blood. The time for what you would call peaceful resolution has long passed. And so we need a small, dedicated party of believers who will begin to defend Islam. And Al-Qaeda represents that dedicated band of brothers, to use one of your terms, which I am fully familiar with because I was educated in the West. I went to your universities. I lived among you. I went to your barbecues. I watched your football games. We know you very well indeed. A confrontation of blood. Muhammad Abdesalam al-Faraj, he writes in The Neglected Duty that the real enemy is the far enemy. It is the United States and its Western allies who, as I suggested, wish to destroy Islam. And therefore, that enemy has to be dealt with. But there is a problem here. It is difficult to deal with the threat that you pose because you have your stooges in the Middle East. You have people who support you, whether it was the Pharaoh Sadat and the next Pharaoh Mubarak in Egypt, Assad in Syria, Saddam in Iraq, Abdullah in Jordan, Muhammad in Morocco. These are what you call Muslim leaders. We call them apostates. These are people who have deserted the faith and deserve death and nothing less. Be clear about that. If you understand our thinking, you already know that. So that is why main enemies reside on the thrones and in the palaces in the major cities and capitals of the Middle East. You are linked to them. And so Muhammad Abdesalam al-Faraj said, we need to attack these people. Assassinations are certainly in order in the defense of Islam. But they had strong Mukhabarat police forces, and it became difficult. And so we eventually would recalculate our strategy and decide we would attack simultaneously the near enemy and the far enemy that you represent. In The Neglected Duty, he points out that the reason for the plight of Muslims over the centuries was their failure to join in the jihad, the holy war. Not the holy war in their greater sense of self-purging and so on, but in the sense of violent conflict. And he calls Muslims to join the conflict and to support the conflict. You may say, well, what of nonviolent means? Can't there be another way? That was addressed by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who now leads al-Qaeda. May God protect him. Ayman al-Zawahiri addressed this in his book, The Bitter Harvest, in which he said, if you think about it, democracy constitutes a religious war against Islam because those who support it have the temerity to think that they should impose parliaments, chambers of deputies, all the institutions you associate with what you call democratic government. And the common denominator with regard to all of these things is that men and women today, God forbid, would make laws. I mean, how dare you say that this should be the way it is in the Islamic world. Remember, I say again, God's law is given. Who are you to make laws? We have the law. This is a very different way, is it not, of looking at the world. So there is no democratic alternative. Knights Under the Banner of the Prophet, another book by Ayman al-Zawahiri, may God protect him, then says, in order to deal with this, we have to have a long war. It will be an international war. It will take place across the globe, and it will be step by patient step until we eliminate the threat to Islam. This essentially summarizes our assumptions about the world. If you like, this is our worldview. Did you know that? You should have. And you may say, well, given that, what is your goal? Our goal has been articulated time and time again. You can go back to 1939 in the spring with Maududi's famous lecture in Lahore, Pakistan, in which he said, we aim to revolutionize the international system. It is corrupt, it is immoral, we will bring a new order, it will be based on Islam. This is at a time when you were preoccupied with the gathering war clouds in Europe. And as the years went by, you would be focused on the global threat posed by the atheist led by the Soviet Union. But all those years were passing, and we had a similar message in many ways. We will change the international system, not as the communists would have it, based on materialism and secularism, God forbid, but based on God's law. And so our goal, and I state it clearly, is to create one single Islamic state. Islam will rule the world. That is the ultimate aim. If you were studying the brothers who were fighting in the jihad against Sadat and Mubarak, and you went on the streets around the Khan al-Khalili, the great bazaar, and you went into the mosques, and you saw the brothers sitting there, they would talk candidly to you, and they would say, Islam will rule the world. Our day will come. You have a film called Sword of Islam, and if you saw that long ago on PBS, you would understand. You would see the brothers speaking to you. Time and time again, Osama bin Laden, may God be pleased with him, said candidly, we are about creating one single Islamic state. So that is the goal. It is clear. How do you get there? Do you get there in stages? Do you get there quickly? No. It will take a long time. But all journeys begin with a single step. You know that. And we are patient. We are unlike you Americans, who like to identify problems and solve them expeditiously. We will wait. We will be patient. As I said, nonviolence is not sufficient. And so what kinds of violence might we use? Those of you who are in this room from the military and some others understand that there is conventional warfare of the kind you saw in your Civil War or in World War II. There is guerrilla warfare, hit-and-run attacks against the military and the police, plus sabotage, of the kind you have seen in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq. It goes back, some say, to Napoleon, but in truth, it predates Napoleon's excursions into Egypt. It is age-old. We were the greatest practitioners of guerrilla warfare in modern times. We brought down a superpower to its knees in Afghanistan. Small hit-and-run attacks across the country, eroding the will of our adversary. And we wrote the encyclopedia of the jihad in Afghanistan, which your intelligence community acknowledges is a great work. And remember, I tell you again, while we were doing this, you were asleep. In all of your professional military schools, in your intelligence agencies, you had decided that the study of insurgency and internal war and terrorism as a part of that was not worthy of your attention. So we were way ahead of you. Not only had we read and studied it, we had practiced it, we had succeeded with it. Terrorism, the threat or use of physical violence against non-combatants, especially civilians, to achieve various purposes. You were probably saying he is going to engage in an apology here. He's going to duck this issue because it sounds so nasty. I tell you, eyeball to eyeball, we accept the use of terrorism. We understand your definition. We have no problem. We are not like that henchman and his cohorts in Syria who would say, well, we're freedom fighters, not terrorists. We don't care about that kind of distinction. It's a confusion of ends and means. We will say terrorism against what you call non-combatants is justifiable on moral and ethical grounds. One of our great writers, a man named Fadl in Egypt, actually has written that the people who say terrorism is not part of Islam should be killed. Now, we know that most Muslims don't agree with that, and our aim is to convert them and to convince them that he was right and we are right. What of the use of weapons of mass destruction? Chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, weapons that can kill in the millions in some cases, nuclear. How do you feel about that? I mean, isn't that beyond the pale? And our answer is categorically no. At the right time of our choosing, if the political calculations are right, God willing, we would use these weapons to kill as many of you as we could. Some of our theoreticians have written that it would be a very great act to carry out 6 simultaneous nuclear attacks on your major cities if we had the capability. The more dead Americans, the more dead Westerners, the more dead infidels, the better. But we don't have that capability. Chemical attacks might have an impact, say on your subway system in New York City. Pick a city. Biological, that would have limited impact but could be deadly. Radiological, in the short term, more feasible. Using hospital waste, various means like that, constructing a bomb, setting it off. Downtown Anchorage, downtown Denver, the Loop in Chicago, Wall Street, down on the Mall in Washington, D.C. And once this entire area is contaminated, for years, if not decades, no one will enter this area. We are fully aware of the impact that would have. Justification for killing people on a mass scale. That has been addressed by our thinkers. Nasser bin Hamad al-Fahad wrote a treatise on the status of the legality of using weapons of mass destruction against the infidels. Read it. And what he did is look at historical analogies. And he asked the question, what happened during the time of the Crusades when Muslims laid siege to Crusader castles? And behind the walls of the castles were prisoners who were Muslims, innocent men, women, and children. Could you attack with catapults and so on? The answer was yes, that the faithful Muslims will go to paradise, as will the innocent women and children. They will have a greater glory. But the most important thing is you will be doing all of this in the defense of Islam, a defense against the Crusaders who wanted to conquer what you call the Holy Land, to impose a Christian order. Does this message, it sounds familiar, doesn't it? You see, we remember the Crusades like they were yesterday. You Americans with short historical memories have fuzzy images about these things. We do not. Suleiman Abu Ghaith, in the Shadow of the Lances, took up the issue of the law of retribution. In our cultural context, revenge looms very significant. By his reckoning, you have killed 4 million Muslims, 2 million of which were children. And given the law of retribution, it is our perfect right to do the same to you. Think back to the time of the Crusades. The Crusades through Arab eyes. Famous book. And read about the cannibals of Mara. Those who came with the cross emblazoned on them, sat at spits, fires, roasted Islamic children alive and ate them. That's why they're called the cannibals. This comes out of the West. This is what you did to us. So you see, when we think of revenge, our mind goes back a long time. It really wouldn't have to, because we could focus on what you've done in recent times. But I think you understand the picture here, that morally and ethically, it is justifiable to kill as many of you as need be. That is Al-Qaeda's point of view. Well, you will say, so you have a one-dimensional strategy. Well, it's not. We do fight as terrorists and guerrillas. We would fight as conventional soldiers if and when the time arose. Ayman al-Zawahiri and many others have addressed that. But you know, it's not just about violence. That's too narrow. Strategic thinkers at the highest level, dealing with grand strategies, bring other things to bear. Diplomacy, economics, information, things your scholars nowadays call soft power. And they integrate these, synergize them, make them work together so that we can accomplish much. So the point is this. As a strategist, I tell you, having been to your graduate schools, having read all of the books, we understand this. This is not complex. And we have fought strategically and acted as such. Diplomacy. You know, some of the great insurgent leaders in contemporary times, their strong suit was, one of their strong suits, diplomacy. That's why they achieved so much. They gathered many friends and supporters by persuading them their cause was right. Before blessed 9/11, we were across the world with our so-called connectors, connecting to people and building this reservoir of support. We have engaged in what you call diplomacy. We're smart insurgent leaders. We've engaged the economic instrument as far as we are capable. Negatively, we have gathered resources through fraud, you call it fraud, writing fraudulent checks, running in sometimes fraudulent enterprises, and so on and so forth. We acknowledge that. But we have also used it positively. That is to say, to win what you guys call in this country hearts and minds. So the brother comes from such a place across the world that we will not mention, and he says we need help to build kindergartens, medical clinic, this, that, or the other thing. And we respond, here, brother, here's assistance. Go back. Help your people. Help your people. Win friends. And you are part of the greater complex, and this will work to all of our benefit. So, diplomacy, economics. We've mentioned the military instrument. Haven't mentioned the information instrument. Ideas. Why not? Because they save the best to last. We are fully mindful that you control the international media. We know about Sky News. We know about CNN International. We know about how you go about it. We feel over time we can deal with that. But let me say this. We control who hears what in many nooks and crannies of this world that really count in this very long war. That's where we're at work. And we have the message and you don't. So you are a young Algerian, 28 years old. You are educated, you've been to college, you want a job, you want to have a family, you want to look after your family. And what are you doing today? You're selling cigarettes on the streets of Algiers, Baghdad, Damascus, name the city. That's your life. There's not much there, is there? But in the process of getting this education and thinking you were going to move ahead, you compromised the truths, the verities of Islam. You didn't pray five times a day. You didn't observe the fast of Ramadan. You compromised your soul, your roots, and you woke up one day with no compensation. Oh, you were promised compensation, but it never came because of the corrupt leaders across the Middle East, the apostates. So now you had a dilemma. You have lost your sense of identity and meaning and worth in this world for nothing. So we say we can address this. People have tried to address this kind of a phenomenon, this rootlessness, anomie, as the sociologist would say. And when they try to address it, they will give you new ideas. Socialism is a Western idea. Socialism in its varieties comes out of the Western political economic body of thinking. You try to impose that in Algeria, to some extent in Egypt, in the People's Democratic Republic of the Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq. You've tried that idea, and it collapsed just as the former Soviet Union collapsed and the Eastern European bloc came apart at the seams. Because the idea was bad, it was irrelevant. So you offer up a worse alternative, capitalism. Capitalism that has now reached the zenith of greed, with the inequalities you see, forget in your country, but across the world. Capitalism without a conscience is what you have, and you would like to offer to us. When Sadat the Pharaoh took power, he dismantled the socialist system, and he began to put in place a capitalist alternative, at which time the poor became poorer and the millionaire classes grew quickly in number. There was more misery. You see, these are the things, these economic and psychological factors that we are mindful of. And so we enter into this picture, and we say to the brothers and sisters, you can regain your soul. You can reconstitute your sense of worth and identity. You can be somebody in this world once again if you do what people have done for centuries, serve God, praise God. We give you the authentic idea. We give you the idea that will bring order, peace, and eventually economic wealth and stability. Your ideas have gone by the sands of time. They have been proven worthless. We reconstitute an old idea and say this is the answer. Ayman al-Zawahiri once said in a letter to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was leading al-Qaeda in Iraq, my brother, remember, one idea is worth 1,000 bullets. The name of the game is to win people's allegiance. Again, your phrase is hearts and minds. We are very aware that ultimately the battle will be resolved in the realm of ideas. So you see, we are strategic thinkers. We use all instruments of power. As things stand today, our organization has been dealt heavy blows by you, but it is not eliminated. Abu Musab al-Suri, one of our prodigious thinkers, three decades ago, said, look, we should fight in small units. We should rethink how we do things. We've got a long time, century, to go about this. And indeed, we have been forced, because of your activities in Afghanistan, to confront this reality. So we now have disaggregated. And you are seeing attacks that are coming from people who are sympathetic to us, as you saw in Boston. And you know that there are plots from groups that are affiliated with us. Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, as you sit here today, is plotting attacks on the United States and in Europe. So we are not gone. We have been hurt. And perhaps the reason for that is that maybe Maybe we incurred the wrath of Allah. Maybe we did some bad things. Maybe there was too much hubris and so on. But you know, we may be down, but we're not out. If you think that because we have been reduced to a small fighting minority, our days are numbered, I will suggest a few historical examples, beginning with the Bolsheviks, who shook the world in 10 days, a minority who took over Russia and created the former Soviet Union. Hitler's National Socialist Party began as a small dedicated minority. Your George Washington led a minority, never won really much of a battle till the very end. And look what that small dedicated minority was able to do. And so on and so forth. So you see, we understand history. And we take solace from that and we gain confidence. The prophet himself lost early battles, but in time would overcome the odds and create the world's greatest religion. Peace be upon him. So our day will come. And in the meantime, you will have to deal with the threats that we fully intend to pose to you. And in the process here, I remind you that if need be, and we will acquire the capability, we will use weapons of mass destruction if our political and strategic calculations call for it. Abu Musab al-Suri, once again, this great thinker, put it directly and well. Dirty bombs for dirty people. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. God is great. You Americans are a curious people. You applaud your own demise.
Well, thank you. Can you hear me? Here. Thank you, Bart O'Neill. I think we have time for a few questions. Since we are recording the program, I would ask that you please wait till the microphone gets to you before a question gets answered. So if you'd raise your hand if you have a question.
So I would like to pose a question to the senior al-Qaeda leader. If you were thinking as Bart O'Neill, how would you combat yourself?
This is a question I'm often asked and I don't answer. But I might come back to later. Al-Qaeda, actually, to be very truthful about this, al-Qaeda has suggested how you should combat al-Qaeda. And we just believe that your political leaders have been so incompetent that they would not act on any of these. One of the things you would do to combat al-Qaeda is to rely heavily on those who have recanted and defected from al-Qaeda, particularly key strategic thinkers, and to broadcast their recantations across the Islamic world. I think, for example, of one mentioned Fadl, the guy who basically argued that terrorism is part of Islam. He has now rejected that. That in turn has created over time a dialogue with Zawahiri, who is beside himself with this. So he now has to spend a lot of time dealing with the recantations of Fadl. Nasser bin Hamad al-Fahad, who justified the use of weapons of mass destruction, was arrested in Saudi Arabia and has been persuaded to recant, which he has done publicly. So that's one thing you can do. The second thing is to exaggerate, embellish some of the attacks that al-Qaeda makes so that the world finds them reprehensible.
Another thing is to reprogram members of Al-Qaeda that have been incarcerated, using not just anybody, but scholars who visit the prisons to have long conversations. This kind of thing has become part and parcel of the Egyptian policy and the Saudi policy of dealing with Al-Qaeda and members of its affiliates. You want to rely on locals in doing all of this. This is clear. And so the name of the game is then to get people who are respected in the Islamic world to write and to talk about Al-Qaeda. You need also, he would argue, to challenge the core fundamental ideas of Al-Qaeda as they were articulated here today by this brilliant strategist from Al-Qaeda. So there are these things that you can do. And you say, well, why on earth would, it was Al-Libi who wrote this, why would he do this? A very, very smart guy that was droned, and so he is no longer a smart guy, but he basically said, you people are so inconsistent and unobservant that you won't even pay attention to me. There are many, many other things that I could say, but as an Al-Qaeda strategist, that's the way you address me. I'm not about to echo Al-Libi. I think he made a mistake in doing this.
Is it okay? Yeah. Salam, thank you for your visit. Can you tell us whether you and your organization believe in the education of girls and women? And if not, why not? Because it's not forbidden in the Quran. And if you do, how will you encourage your brothers to get more girls into schools?
Well, we certainly encourage education of women. And we think that some of the brothers have made a mistake in certain places in discouraging that, if not undermining it. The question would become the nature of that education. We feel it must be grounded in Islamic studies. But many of us, not all, many of us believe that it could be expanded to other things that are important and related to service to the community. But you must remember, when you are dealing with the Islamic areas of the world, particularly the Arab Middle East, in many places, women fully accept their role and status in life. It is those who are trying to liberate women in the West, and of which we are fully aware because you're so public about it, that seem more concerned. So when we underscore the need for women to have a particular place in the context of Islamic law and culture, we are playing to the mainstream. You sometimes misconstrue those who are trying to change the system with the thinking of the majority of women who are practitioners of the Islamic faith. You need to understand better our culture and not to impose your thinking through your lenses, which are distorted.
Hi. Just as you're an Al-Qaeda leader, I want to, for a second, assume that I'm a policymaker in the United States, and I'm going to say to you that what all you have assumed about us is wrong. The real reason we are in the Middle East is because of oil, to protect our good friends and allies, being Israel, and I really don't care about separation of your church or state. I don't really care if you ever get democratic. I don't really care if you're dictators, because we have dictators all around the world, but we don't care about them. The only reason we're in the Middle East is for the oil and about these women's rights and all these other issues. We just talk about them just to sell it to our American public. What do you say to that?
Well, I say that we are fully aware that you have many different voices and opinions in the United States, of which we are very cognizant. You articulate one of those views, and it might be called the realpolitik view, which is this is simply about petroleum and maintaining the credibility of your alliance to the state of Israel. We would say that there are many others out there who represent a different tradition, a tradition that would call for the change of Arab governments, that would be captivated by something called the Arab Spring. And all of that, of course, is part and parcel of what? That particular part of the American population, the population of the UK, that wants to change and wants to separate mosque and state and to impose what you call democracy over time. So we would hear you as one voice. We would understand that voice. We would agree with much of what you said, But we would also say there are all these other voices in America. Indeed, in a meeting last night, I heard a very articulate exposition of those other views from a young student from the University of Alaska. So you have one voice, the realistic voice, but I heard the idealistic voice, and that's part and parcel of the whole strain. Whether it's realism or idealism, as we process this, it all comes together as a threat to Islam. So Al-Qaeda sees you as a multifaceted threat, regardless of your basic philosophy, such as it is.
Thank you again for your very enlightening speech.
Will you join?
The jihad? It's not likely. But that being said, Islam is such a huge religion throughout the world. And I think in the West, we are given the perception that Al-Qaeda is a small group of right-wing or very, not right-wing, Islam is extremism. It's not the mainstream. How do the rest of the Islamists throughout the world view Al-Qaeda? Are they the extreme Islamists, or are they, you know, something to be feared, something to be kind of put aside as just a small part, or are they viewed as, maybe they're right?
Well, we're fully aware of all of the studies and public opinion polls that have been done in the Islamic world. And we understand completely that many of those who call themselves Muslims utterly reject Al-Qaeda. Indeed, we are pretty hard-headed, realistic, strategic thinkers. So we know that there will be a long road ahead to convince them to join Al-Qaeda. And we believe we can do that. But for now, yes, the majority of those who call themselves Muslims do reject Al-Qaeda. And we believe it can change. I think of Iraq and the letter that went to Zarqawi from Zawahiri. And he said to him, this is an example. He said, brother, he said, you can't attack innocent people because that creates a counterproductive effect. You can't attack members of the clergy, especially the Shia, because the people won't understand that. It takes time to convince the people that we are right. And so counterproductive violence undermines that. But embedded in that exchange of letters between the two is the acknowledgement that, you know, it will take time to convince the majority of Muslims. So what you put your finger on is something that I, as a hard-headed strategist, would say is a major problem and a weakness for Al-Qaeda. And indeed, Abu Yahya al-Libi argued this when he talked about how to confront Al-Qaeda. He said, you know, most Muslims don't accept this. And your job would be to reinforce their rejection of Al-Qaeda. But you, again, are not competent enough to figure that out. I think, by the way, Brother Al-Libi was wrong about that.
My name's Jeremy Regal. I'm a paratrooper, spent about 46 months in Afghanistan dealing with the effects of the strategy you spoke of today. And I appreciate your attempts in broadening our understanding of that strategy. My question kind of dovetails into the last one. You say that most of the Muslim world doesn't support Al-Qaeda, which I completely agree with. But at the same time, many of the good Muslim leaders within the world are reluctant to speak out against the strategy of Al-Qaeda. You know, what can we do effectively to influence those Muslim leaders to be that voice, to provide that other side of Islam that will hopefully help reduce the extent of terrorism across the world?
Well, to make it clear, first of all, that Al-Qaeda represents a minority, and we acknowledge they represent a majority, not fall into the trap of saying all Muslims are sympathetic to Al-Qaeda. Second thing you can do is in certain specific places is provide security, because for those who will stand up and criticize Al-Qaeda, there is a bullet at the other end to kill them, as you well know. So security is very important. Where that is relevant and needs to be done. Those are two things, certainly, that would come to mind, and others may, you know, come up here in the discussion. But in the end, it is your business to make sure you have support from the majority of Muslims. I would say, as I reflect more on this, that you need to understand that on issues having little to do directly with Al-Qaeda, you have to respect the differences you have with the Arab states. The Arabs are going to differ with you, the Persians will differ with you, the French will differ with you, the British, the Russians, on various issues. States don't all agree on things and think alike. And so it is true that you need to acknowledge that and therefore get beyond the notion of saying if they don't agree with us and do what we want, we can't deal with them. You have to accept differences of honest differences of opinion. And then I will tell you this, you must begin to make progress on, not solve overnight, the Arab-Israeli conflict. Because in Al-Qaeda, there is a clear awareness that this issue can be used and manipulated much to Al-Qaeda's benefit. I mean, you have Hamas, which is a hard Islamic group that Al-Qaeda doesn't like particularly, but in power in the Gaza Strip. That's just one of many examples of what happens when this issue is not resolved. The Arab-Israeli conflict is a lightning rod for the propagandists, especially in Al-Qaeda, who simply shrug their shoulders when the Israelis stonewall on things like settlements and say, we told you so. What do you expect? Do you think nonviolent resolution will work here? So we have to get on with the business of diffusing those things. And we have to, in our calculations, and I'm talking now as in the counter Al-Qaeda mode, we have to weigh in considerations about the reactions in the Muslim world when we attack a state that is perceived to be part of it. This will be part of President Obama's calculus. Many things here he's wrestling with, but one thing would be the unintended consequences of some kind of an action, whatever it is in Syria, that plays into Al-Qaeda's hands. Ironically, even though Al-Qaeda despises the Assad regime, they're secular and they're Alawite, offshoot of the Shia. What could be worse? You know, from Al-Qaeda's point of view, the Shia are worse than the Christians and the Jews. That's exactly what they say. Exactly what they say. But they would be quite happy to try to use an invasion of Syria, an attack on Syria, a bombardment of Syria for propaganda purposes. So you have to be very careful in the days and years ahead about where you enter the Middle East and South Asia with military force. This is much of it in the realm of the battle of ideas and emotions and feelings.
Hi. So as part of the strategy in Afghanistan, I've seen that they've transitioned some soldiers into being kind of community builders or even social workers. How do you encounter and how do you deal with that strategy? And maybe as a follow-up, what are you most afraid of that the Western world can offer that Islamic leaders cannot?
What can the Western, offer Islamic leaders?
Yeah, what can we offer the people, the populations that you're trying to close off that?
I think one word might summarize that and is hope, but it is a realistic definition of hope. Hope is an incremental move forward economically, socially, politically. No illusions that you can change the Middle East and South Asia in short order over, you know, in a short period of time. A long time ago, we fought an insurrection in the Philippines, and along came reformers like Magsaysay, and they constructed an incremental program of reforms. And when that happened, the rank and file began to defect from the Huk Balahap movement. In historical retrospect, what that program amounted to, actuality, was very little. But it created an image that the government was finally doing something. And so a lot of people said, we're out of this conflict. A similar situation in Oman in the 1960s, and I could go on at length about that. So we can do what we can do, given our increasing economic limitations, to be helpful as relevant. But that's easier said than done. It's easier said than done in a war zone like Afghanistan, to send out Agency for International Development people where they can't be secure because the Taliban will kill them. It's that simple. It's easier said than done because sometimes the things that you want to do in a secure area actually don't work. They're counterproductive. It's not what the local people want. So you have to really understand what it is in particular areas that the local people feel would be helpful in terms of their daily affairs. Not something divined way back in Washington somewhere as relevant stuff to do in Afghanistan or anywhere that in this particular region, this particular province is not relevant. So you have to have a shrewd, informed, differentiated counterinsurgency policy that's relevant. And surrounding all of that has to be a mindset that this is going to take a long time. And I'm sure the guys who served in Afghanistan, I hear them say time and again, some of them would say it's like going back to the biblical age. This is a society, and if you study the war against the Russians, and we did that for 10 years, one of the few places that did it in Washington, the power of tradition is enormous. And in the postmortems of that war, the Russians would say, the biggest mistake we made was not understanding the politics, the culture of Afghanistan, and the force and power of tradition. Biggest mistake we made. And we've made some of those mistakes. It took a long time to begin to understand that, and we still struggle with it. You can't do it overnight. So you got to get on the road to doing it. But don't have great expectations. Problem. United States, short-term perspective, limited capabilities. American people want to get out of there. A lot of people in the military say the time is up, let's go. What can you do in that short window? I am not an optimist. I'm a pessimist. But Holtz said, you know, and a pessimist is simply an optimist with experience. I have one last comment I want to share with you. You've been a good audience, exceptional good audience, not only in terms of your questions, but nobody has threatened me here today. And I've been down that road. And I share with you a meeting, it was the Committee on Council on Foreign Relations in Denver, in which a guy was sitting right there, and I watched him through the whole thing, and I could see his face getting red, studying his body language as an old professor would do, like, what's coming here? And he finally, at the very end, and I give it to you exactly as he said it to me, he stood up, and he pointed his finger, and he said, I'll tell you what, you SOB, I'll tell you what's going to happen to you. And I said, what is that? And he said, your wife is going to stab you in the back in the middle of the night. And I said, that complicates my strategic calculus because I have three wives.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, Bart O'Neill. We have one last piece of business before we close up, and that's to draw the winner of the bread bowl. If I can ask Bard to... It is number 903299. One lucky winner. Still here? Let's try one more. Oh, here we are. Excellent. Okay. Well, Bard, pick it up afterwards, okay?
He's great.
Bard, we do have a gift for you in hope that it'll buy some measure of peace.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope you all enjoyed today's presentation. Remember that the World Affairs Council is member supported. If you like what you saw today, if you'd like more programming like this, please consider picking up one of the cards at your table and becoming a member. I'd also like to remind you, as Lisa said, that our next program is next Tuesday, where we will have a host Fran Ulmer and Ambassador David Bolton speak on U.S. leadership in an emerging Arctic. Thank you all very much. Have a good day.